Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
In fact, it's completely planned, mapped, written, rehearsed. You know, you can't make a movie that every angle is placed and stuff just by accident. It just doesn't happen like this.
The Richard Linklater trilogy, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, may seem largely improvised. But Julie Delpy, who stars with Ethan Hawke and is Oscar-nominated for co-writing the screenplay, says it wasn't. Plus, another Oscar nominee, the filmmaker behind the surreal documentary The Act of Killing, in which Indonesian death squad leaders gleefully reenact murders as if they were starring in a Hollywood movie. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So this is a day of unhappy banter. We're going to start with the tragic death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, obviously a giant, an Oscar winner, a guy whose performances have thrilled people. But also, this is yet again one of these situations where a major star is in the middle of very major projects. In this case, we're talking about the Hunger Games trilogy, the last two films. And a studio has to figure out what to do. We've seen this recently with Paul Walker's untimely death. It seems at this point that Lionsgate has enough of the second and third of these, the last two films in the trilogy, done to proceed. But obviously, this is a kind of thing that no studio wants to have to contend with.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure that they are completely finished with Mockingjay Part 2. The final book of the trilogy is being made into two separate films. The first part of Mockingjay, apparently Philip Seymour Hoffman had wrapped his work. According to the studio, he still had a number of days, maybe as much as a week on the second film, so it's unclear how they're going to solve that problem. They have some time. The latter of the movie is not out till 2015. And as you said, I mean, this is a guy also who is at the peak of his career. I mean, he had two movies in Sundance, God's Pocket and Most Wanted Man. And I think it's going to affect how those films are received, and it's going to put a kind of an odd spell over his most recent work as well.
And there's also a Showtime series that was supposed to begin, and that cannot happen. You know, obviously, if it is as it appears to be, and this was a death from a drug overdose, you know, this is one of these situations the studios have to grapple with troubled talent. And, you know, I guess it is essential and mandatory for them to ensure talent like Philip Seymour Hoffman. At this point, I don't quite know how that is done, given, you know, that he had addiction problems in the past. But I guess, you know, for a price, you can do that. But we've seen again and again recently with other actors, Corey Monteith. This is a demanding business. It takes, you know, these are sensitive people, oftentimes in a lot of pain. And that creates opportunity for the studios to deal with terrible, terrible problems.
Yeah, and I think it's tragic when anybody dies at an early age, and obviously hundreds of people die any given week from drug overdoses. I mean, I think it also shows that you can have so much going for you, and this is true of any number of addicts. It can look like you're successful, it can look like you're happy, and addiction is such a horrible demon, and it's really unfortunate for everybody who loses somebody that's close to them through an overdose. And I think for people who loved Philip Seymour Hoffman as an actor, it's especially sad because he had such a great body of work and had who knows how many more great roles in him.
Absolutely. And another totally grim story, over the weekend, Mia Farrow's daughter, Dylan Farrow, wrote an open letter, which was published on Nicholas Kristof's website in the New York Times, alleging that she had been molested as a child, very painful allegations by Woody Allen. Woody Allen has denied these allegations. Sony Pictures Classics, which released his latest movie, Blue Jasmine, has pointed out that Woody Allen has not been accused of any crime formally. But this is what a difficult, fraught situation. And I feel, John, I assume you do as well, whatever awful thing transpired within that family, whatever Woody Allen may have done, the timing of this feels as though it is designed to undermine Oscar chances for Blue Jasmine, which may seem ludicrous and petty, but you do have to ask yourself, why is this coming to light now, especially after Ronan Farrow tweeted during the Golden Globes about these allegations. And, you know, years have passed, and this is the moment at the absolute, in the peak, in the middle of the voting, where this stuff is now coming out. Many people have applauded Dylan Farrow's courage, but I don't know, John, I don't think this is necessarily going to impact Blue Jasmine at the Oscars for that reason.
I'm not sure about that, but I also think it's a very tricky subject, and you can ask yourself why this didn't come out around Midnight in Paris, which was equally celebrated a couple of years ago. But I think the timing is very interesting. But I think if you are somebody who believed Dylan Farrow, and her allegations were very specific about what she recounted in the column in the New York Times, if you believe her, and Dylan and the people who believe her feel her story has not been heard, in many ways, this is exactly the right time to tell that story, because a lot of people are talking about Woody Allen. Blue Jasmine has a lot of Oscar attention. He received a special award at the Golden Globe. So a lot of people are talking about him and his films. So if you are trying to get your side of the story out, people are definitely going to be interested in listening. I think it's absolutely going to have an effect on Blue Jasmine. I think we'll find out when the Oscars are presented in the first week of March. But I think that's a kind of a side issue. If the Farrow family believes that this is a story that needs to be aired, they've absolutely chosen the perfect time to get it talked about.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times.
Coming up later in the show, actress, writer, director Julie Delpy. But first, you have never seen a documentary like The Act of Killing, 8 years in the making. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. In the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Act of Killing, Indonesian gangsters and thugs who slaughtered hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, during an anti-communist purge in the mid-1960s, enthusiastically recreate their crimes as if they were heroes in a Hollywood movie. The Indonesian government has never acknowledged the massacre, and the perpetrators have never been held to account. In fact, quite the opposite. Over the course of years, our guest filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer invited the killers to reenact for the camera how they tortured and garroted or beheaded their victims. They readily agreed, choosing various genres to recreate the murders, from film noir to fantasy musical. In the opening sequence, beautiful young women with flowers in their hair dance under a towering tropical waterfall. They're playing angels welcoming grateful murder victims to heaven. One of the central figures in the film, a death squad leader named Anwar, has hired a choreographer who yells at the dancers, "Smile, more teeth, don't let the camera catch you looking bad." Oppenheimer's aim in making The Act of Killing was to reveal the emotional toll of the atrocities on the perpetrators and, more broadly, on the people of Indonesia. The killers bring a lot of commitment to staging these reenactments, using prosthetic makeup, costumes, and even bringing in some crew to assist. Oppenheimer says some who have seen his documentary come away with the impression that the killers were actually making their own separate film.
Anwar and his friends, the men in The Act of Killing, take ownership of the reenactments. They really want to show what they did, but they also really want to use the process to express their feelings about what they did. And of course, for that reason, it feels like we as viewers think they must be making a movie, because why else would they care so much about making these scenes?
So when did it come to you to say, why don't you reenact this for me?
Well, the method of reenactment really came out of the fact that all of the perpetrators I was filming were taking me to the places they killed, and maybe because they thought this is what a film should be, would launch into spontaneous demonstrations. There were two men in particular who took me down to a riverbank where they helped kill hundreds of people. Every night they would get a busload and drag them down and kill them, cut their heads off and throw them in the river. And they were taking turns playing the victim and the perpetrator. We see Anwar doing something very similar. The very first day I met him, he takes me to a rooftop, says, "I have to reenact this properly," shows how he killed with wire because it was cleaner. So when I proposed to the killers, "Look, you want to show me what you've done, so show me what you've done in whatever way you wish," I did not anticipate these elaborate genre-inspired, ever more surreal dramatizations. I imagined that they would show me how they killed. But after I met Anwar, I screened back for him the footage of him the very first day I met him. He takes me to this rooftop, shows how he killed, and then dances the cha-cha-cha in the place where he's killed people.
Right.
And he says he's a good dancer because he was drinking and taking drugs and going out dancing to forget what he's done. And so his pain, his trauma was right there, even as he's doing something more grotesque than anyone else had done in the 2 years that I'd been filming before that. He dances where he's killed hundreds of people. And I think to myself, if I show this to him, will he recognize the meaning of what's going on here? Will he recognize the meaning of what he's done in the mirror of the movie? And that screening back to him, that simple step of showing him himself in the film, triggered this process that was unbelievably complicated and rich, where he looks very disturbed when he watches himself on screen. I'm sure he's disturbed by what he did, but he dares not say it, because to say this looks awful or what have I done or even this makes me look bad is to admit it was wrong. And he's never been forced to do that. So instead he says, my clothes are wrong. I should dye my hair. My acting's wrong. He lies to himself and to me about what's really wrong. What's really wrong is the killings were wrong. Not that it's a bad scene, but he proposes embellishment after embellishment, and the method's always the same. We shoot one scene, he watches it. We shoot the next scene, he watches it. We shoot the next scene, he watches it. And he proposes more and more elaborate embellishments, always trying to run away from the true meaning of what he's done and maybe also deal with it.
So when he's shooting the heaven sequence or some of these reenactments, is he the director at that moment? Or who is?
Anwar is not a filmmaker. So Anwar, we would have intense discussions about what Anwar wanted. Sometimes he drafts or enlists the Indonesian state television soap opera crew to help him realize his scenes. But whenever they were there, it was a big film crew and lots of assistant directors from the state television and also paramilitary leaders who came in as assistant directors. It was chaos, and Anwar was unable to access any real sincere emotions with all these, with this sort of enormous peanut gallery around him. We would let him do that. We would let him work that way when we wanted to show how he and his friends negotiate what they should show, what they should not show, what they want to show, what they don't want to show, as a way of showing how they want to be seen. But when we wanted to go into deep emotions, I would ask Anwar, what do you have in mind for the scene? For example, there's a series of gangster scenes that are done as a film noir, and Anwar said, I want to do it like one of my favorite gangster films, Scarface. But of course, I didn't know if he meant the Al Pacino Scarface or the Paul Mooney Scarface from the 70s or the 30s. And I had to show him the two films to say, which do you mean? Do you mean something bright and sunny that's set in Miami? Or do you mean this low-key, dark film noir from Howard Hawks? And he meant the film noir. So then we had to think, okay, how can we create low-key lighting, a film noir set, where Anwar is also free to improvise? Because normally when you have low-key lighting, if you step out of your blocking, you fall into shadow and you can't be seen. So I worked with my cinematographer to create a film noir space. It wasn't so easy, where there were enough pools of light that he could move through the space and freely set up the scene, direct the scene, tell what he wanted, call action when he was ready, perform the scene, be taken somewhere emotionally. And when he was either he or I, depending on whether he was emotionally too deep to call cut, one of us would call cut. And then he could reflect on the scene all in the same space, all in real time, captured by two cameras. So in those scenes, we helped him direct his scenes, helped him realize his scenes, always trying to make them as powerful as possible.
So the Indonesian soap opera crews come into the mix because
in North Sumatra, the whole province is run by the killers and their protégés and the leaders of this gangster paramilitary movement.
So they're all pals.
And they're all pals. And the head, the North Sumatra studios of TVRI, the Indonesian State Television Network, is run by these men's friends. So all they had to do was call up their friends and say, hey, we're making a film about the heroic things we did in 1965. Will you help us? And the answer was yes, to such an extent that when word got out that Anwar and the governor of the province,
they're lining up.
And yeah, and the publisher of the biggest newspaper in the town were all making this film together, the state television studio took it upon themselves to produce a talk show. It's one of the most surreal things in the film, hyping the movie before it's even finished.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with the documentary filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer about his movie, The Act of Killing. He had 60 Indonesian crew members, including a co-director who was a vital collaborator over the many years that he worked on the film,
but they're credited simply as anonymous because their involvement with the movie could put them at risk.
We're all vigilant. We're all careful. We all have contingency plans, but I don't think that they're living in day-to-day fear.
And you weren't?
I was afraid at moments when the process would break down. So there's a couple moments in the film where you see people, one, a government minister, a minister in the government, questioning what the film will do and interrupting the shooting to warn everybody that they shouldn't be making this film with me. In those moments, I was palpably afraid. After one of those moments, I heard through my headphones, one of the two perpetrators in the film, one of the two main killers in the film, Adi, saying, "Don't you think Josh is a communist?" to everybody else.
Oh, God, that's like a really bad direction for things to go in.
And exactly. So I had to stop it there. And I had to go up to him and say, "If you have a question for me, I'm right here. You ask me." But I think apart from those moments, maybe there were moments when we were in danger and I wasn't aware of it, but I was generally not afraid.
So at this point, you have the Oscar nomination. Does Anwar know about that?
Yeah, I mean, when Anwar saw the film, the complete film, he was very moved by it. He was emotional. He was silent for a long time. Then he said, "This film shows what it's like to be me." And so I was in touch with him for a long time to see if he was being blamed by the paramilitary movement for making the film. They haven't blamed him. They've blamed me. They hate the film and they hate me. That's as it should be.
You're not going back to Indonesia anytime soon?
I can't go back to Indonesia. I could probably get in, but I don't think I'd get out again.
Get back out, yeah. That's the tricky bit.
But I think that, you know, Anwar said he was glad the film was nominated. He was hoping it would be. He knew it was going to be announced on the 16th of January. And glad because he was glad more people this way would hear his story and see what it means.
You did not submit the film, obviously, to censorship board in Indonesia. So how you had to sort of, you didn't have a conventional theatrical release, to put it mildly, right?
No, we didn't. Our whole strategy for releasing the film in Indonesia was to avoid the film being banned. They'd banned films about East Timor and all sorts of other human rights violations. So we knew before we could really start screening the film, we had to build up very high-level support. We screened the film, therefore, to Indonesia's leading news publishers, news editors, filmmakers, celebrities, intellectuals, writers, educators. Everyone who saw the film said, "Everyone in Indonesia needs to see this film," and they started holding screenings. Those screenings were by invitation only at first, also so as not to provoke a ban, but they were big. They were 200 people at a time. As of last summer, there had been thousands of screenings, and most of them were public. And the reason they'd become public was the media started to report on the genocide as a genocide. Tempo magazine, the biggest news publication in Indonesia, decided to break what had been a nearly 50-year silence on the killings. And they came out with a special double edition of the magazine, packed with 75 pages of perpetrators' boastful testimony, much like I had gathered in the 2 years before I met Anwar, and another 25 pages about the film. It sold out through three printings because Indonesians were astonished that this Holocaust that underpins everything, but never is talked about in the mainstream media, was suddenly filling the most important publication in a double edition. We then made the film available for free download, for free streaming in a geo-blocked form on YouTube, and the film has been seen presumably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times.
Joshua Oppenheimer is a filmmaker. His movie, The Act of Killing, has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Act of Killing is now available on Blu-ray, DVD, and numerous streaming services. It's also been re-released in some theaters. Coming up after a short break, Julie Delpy on becoming a writer, despite the many, including Sam Shepard, who told her to stick with acting. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Before Midnight is the third film in the Richard Linklater trilogy starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. What began in 1995 with Before Sunrise and resumed 9 years later with Before Sunset now concludes with the two lead characters, Jesse and Celine, as a married couple with kids. They're still striving to understand their relationship by talking it all over.
Well, I know you better than I know anybody else on the planet, but maybe that's not saying much.
What? This is great.
Right.
You know, I feel close to you.
Yeah.
But sometimes, I don't know, I feel like you're breathing helium and I'm breathing oxygen.
What makes you say that?
See? I'm trying to truly connect and you make a joke.
Before Midnight was co-written by Delpy, Hawke, and Linklater. The script, like the one for Before Sunset, has been nominated for Oscar for Best Screenplay. Delpy tells the business producer Darby Maloney that many people assume these movies aren't so much written as improvised.
And in fact, it's completely planned, mapped, written, every detail, every word. We don't change the words. We don't change the pauses. We don't change anything. You know, you can't make a movie that every angle is placed and stuff just by accident. It just doesn't happen like this. You know, when you do an improvised film, and I've done it before, it's full of jump cuts. You don't have long takes where people expose the entire backstory, future situation like that. It doesn't happen. I would have to be a genius, and I'm not a genius. So it's actually written, rehearsed, and et cetera, et cetera. So
what's the process for writing?
We've done it differently on every film, depending on our life situation, actually. On this film, Richard realized that Ethan and I and himself, we were so busy with our lives, and we decided that we needed to be locked in a room together in the location of where we were going to shoot. So it was possible to do it at very minimal cost on this film because one of the financiers owns an hotel in Greece, so it was easy to put us up and everything. So that's what we did. We just went to Greece, and it sounds very luxurious, but the reality is our family had a good time, and we were in a room, you know, from 9 to midnight every day writing. So we could have been anywhere, but it was kind of good we were there because, first of all, we were, you know, disconnected from our lives, which is very difficult to disconnect us from our lives. And we needed to do that to actually focus because we only had 10 weeks to write the screenplay before we went straight into shooting. Actually, we had 2 weeks of rehearsal and then shoot for 15 days. So we didn't have, you know, much time. So we needed to be 100% focused and stuff. So that's why Richard decided we needed to be all together away from everything. And also what we did is that we went on to all the location scout, which really helped us define how long the scenes would be in that walk scene, how long the scene would be there and there and there, you know. So it was actually a good system. Last film, it was different. We wrote most of the film Before Sunset through emails. Like, we talked for 3 days, and then I send a first draft, and then Ethan sent me, you know, a lot of material that I inserted in it. I mean, it was very, it was a different way of writing it.
So you write a lot now. Did the writing emerge because it was inevitable? Like, you were sort of always going to find yourself writing, or was it a response to the kind of roles that you were being offered?
I was always going to be a writer. I was always going to write. As long as I can remember, I was struggling with it. I wasn't sure I should do it. I was like, oh, I should stick to being an actress. A lot of people were actually discouraging me to be a writer. You know, it was a very long road of, you know, not much support. not from my close friends and stuff, but more the work.
Like people in the business?
Yeah, people in the business and stuff, but not necessarily creative people in the business, more like the business side of the business.
Like representation?
Yeah. Like, we're not big fans of the idea of me writing. Now, they obviously, it's not an issue anymore.
It sounds like your participation in this trilogy really helped you figure out what else you wanted to do with your career.
Yeah, from the first film. I mean, the first film, we were not credited as writers, but we did a tremendous amount of writing on the final film. And a lot of the scenes I had written, luckily, were like the scenes that journalists, critics said, oh, this is my favorite scene in the film. And I was like, oh, I can write. Oh, it's not that bad. Oh, what I write is not that bad. And it came, and it was very helpful because, in a way, I wrote something without being credited, so I didn't take the risk of being exposed in a way, but I saw the result of it. Because I had written before, but then,
you know, I was working with Sam Shepard on a movie when I was 20, and I kind of translated him a line of one of my film, and he said, Julie, you're very pretty. Please don't do that to yourself. Which, listen, he's a great writer. He's a much better writer.
Yeah, that's a little condescending.
Maybe a little macho, you know, a touch. I wouldn't say Sam Shepard is a macho, but, you know, a touch of like, you know, it's very funny. I think it's very funny. But it kind of blocked me for years. I was like, oh, okay, so I'm not a writer. And then when I wrote on Before Sunrise, the first film, I felt so good. And then I started writing again, basically. So I had a blog for like 2 years because I was like, a great American playwright thinks I shouldn't write. So why should I write? And then it came back pretty quickly. Luckily, it wasn't forever trauma.
So you've directed 2 feature films now, right?
No, in America, they've seen 2. I've directed 4.
Oh.
I directed a film called The Skylab that never came to the US, which is a fully French movie. It's an English name because it's in reference to the space station. And the other film was called The Countess, which is on Netflix, but it's not. It didn't come out in the theater. I had an insane bad luck with this film and timing and everything. Nothing I'm sad about, because in the end, it was very, very, very successful in France. And it allows me to have financing for every film I want to do because it was so well regarded. So since all independent film are basically financed from Europe, not all, but like half of them, it's very helpful for me. So
we're talking at your home in Hollywood. Why did you decide to settle here when you have backers in Europe? You are European.
You know, well, now I'm stuck here because the father of my son is here. And my son is here, so I'm stuck here forever. I made a home here. I'm not sure why, you know?
Is there a benefit in terms of your work, in terms of your career, to be here, or not necessarily?
I mean, yes, I have projects here, like interesting projects here, and I do manage quite well in this business. I mean, I have no problem having meetings, and I don't know. It's, why not? You know, I feel it's always better to be in a place where you can aim bigger than in a place where you know you're going to be always limited to certain things. And I feel even if I do end up making films in France the way I'm making them, or with French financing, you know, it's good to aim to other things too. And why not being here? You know, you're in the center of where it happens, you know, and it's good to be here, even if you don't really, you're not fully part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I am part of it. I mean, I'm writing a film for HBO. I'm developing a show for HBO. I'm doing a lot of things here. They're not yet out, but they're happening, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. I have possibly a big comedy happening, and we'll see what happens. I have no idea what my future will be like, but I have written 5 films, and that's gonna, I mean, you know, I just have to find the time to shoot them, because most of them are financed, believe it or not. So, I mean, they're all financed. I'm like in this crazy situation. When I tell my American filmmaker friends, who are actually more successful than me, but are having a hard time together movies, they're so jealous that I'm French, because half of those films are basically put together in France by producers, friends of mine, people I work with, and it's not as hard as here.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julie Delpy co-stars in and co-wrote the movie Before Midnight with Ethan Hawke and Richard Linklater. It's available on DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming.
Let me sing you a waltz. Out of nowhere, out of my thoughts, let me sing you a waltz.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.